This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 93-year-old Carl Appel of Los Osos, California. He's lived there since 1980, but he grew up around Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And in February 1945, he was a 19-year-old Marine approaching a small volcanic island in the Pacific that he'd never heard of before, but he would never be able to forget. Nearly 7,000 Americans would be killed, and Carl would become one of the more than 19,000 Americans wounded in the five-week battle for Iwo Jima.
And they didn't expect it to be so difficult to take. They didn't know what was hiding inside Mount Suribachi and all those tunnels and all those defenses. And it sounds like they didn't think they were even going to need your division, the 3rd Division.
Well, that's right. And they knew they were dug in, but not as much as they were, because they'd pop up out of tunnels, and then when they were getting shelled or something, they'd go back down, and so as a result, all the bombing and so forth really didn't do that good as far as eliminating the enemy.
Right, because before any Marines ever set foot on Iwo Jima, it had been bombed and shelled and just blasted by American forces for quite a long time. So if you don't know what's inside, you expect, hey, that's going to soften things up pretty well, and the reality was quite a bit different from that.
Correct. When we had the opportunity, or when I went back, I should say, to revisit Iwo on the 50th anniversary, we had a chance to look in some of these tunnels and so forth, and we could certainly see how the bombing wouldn't have affected them at all.
So your division is not supposed to be needed, but because the casualties were so severe, they call you into action. How did that unfold for you? How did you find out you guys were going in, and did you understand why?
Well, we were, say, floating reserve, and at night we'd pull away from the island, and then in the mornings we'd pull back in close enough that we could see the shore, and we could see planes diving down and little dots running around on the island. It appeared that we were, you know, inflicting quite a bit of damage. But then word came through the onboard speakers that we were going to be called in because of the terrible casualties that the Marines were taking at that time. So we boarded the landing craft, and the balance of the 3rd Division landed on D plus 5.
Well, and as you describe being in floating reserve and being able to see what's happening, you know, the question that comes to my mind, and probably a lot of people listening, is did you see that one thing that so many people have seen since, because it's probably the most famous photograph of all time, the Marines lifting the flag atop Mount Suribachi, the 2nd flag, there had been a smaller one put up earlier. Did you happen to see a Stars and Stripes flying atop the mountain?
Yeah, we saw the flag. We didn't actually see the raising of the flag, but we did see it when it was up there. That certainly lifted our spirits a great deal.
Was that misleading at all? Did it make you think that your side had made more progress than they really had?
Well, not necessarily. We knew that Suribachi was a real difficult thing to take, and that flag, when they put it up, they were still receiving fire from the Japanese in caves and so forth, were still entrenched in the Mount Suribachi.
So you see that from the ship, then they've got you 5 days after the initial landing, they have you on this landing craft going into the shore. So why don't we pick up the story there? What was that teenage Marine seeing, hearing, experiencing from that point on?
Well, when we were going in, they held us off for a while for some reason. I guess the shore, landing shore or beaches, were so jammed with destroyed vehicles and landing craft that they had to clear enough space for us to get in. And when we went in, of course, they dropped the ramp and we went ashore. And of course, there's a series of terraces from the beach up to the main part of the island. And I'm sure most of you can relate to running in sand. You take one step forward and you can go slide back too. So it's quite a challenge to get up to a place where we're on the level and could get into some cover. We progressed up to airfield number one, where we dug in for the night. And during the night, we received some artillery shells in and around the airfield there. Fortunately, I was able to get into a foxhole that had already been dug, thanks to another Marine somewhere. And so I got in that foxhole and put my poncho over me. Then, of course, we'd get these shells in here. Unfortunately, none landed in my hole.
Did they land in some other people's holes?
Not to my knowledge. I did hear that there were some casualties, but I didn't see it or witness it at all. And the following morning, we moved up to a position of what they called immediate reserve, just behind the main line. When moving up, I saw my first dead Marine. I remember observing him, and apparently he had been standing on the edge of a foxhole, or shell hole, I should say. And when he was hit, he just fell straight back. I remember looking at his lacings on his leggings and just thinking to myself that when you lace those, you didn't think that you were going to end up like this. And in looking at him a little closer, he had been hit directly in the head and clenched in his fingers. His right hand was the stub of a cigarette. And apparently he had been standing up next to that hole smoking, and Japanese aimed at that cigarette glow and hit him right in the head.
That's got to get your attention and make you wonder what's going to happen to you.
Yes, yes it did. And they say there's no atheists in foxholes, and I certainly agree with that, because I did an awful lot of praying.
I believe it. Did you do much sleeping at all? I mean, you talk about that first night and then a second night. I mean, was it difficult to actually close your eyes and sleep?
Yes, I don't think that I really got a good sleep at all, because of the worry that you had and the shelling. It just wasn't conducive to sleeping. Actually, the second day, we'd moved up to airfield number two, going to spend the night at that position, and then the following day go into an attack to try to take Hill Peter, which is north of the airfield. I was buddied up with one of our squad members, Joseph Bandiera. We started digging a foxhole or a hole so that we could get in. You know what it is like trying to dig a hole in the sand? It just keeps sliding in. I had was assigned what they call a pick-matic, which was like a pick on one side and another blade on the other side of it, and that didn't work worth a darn in sand. And below us, there were two dead Marines, and they had been digging in to make a foxhole. They didn't have helmets. I don't know what happened to them, whether the Japanese got them or what, but they're bareheaded, and the one had a shovel, so I had that pick-matic. Well, that wasn't doing any good, so I went down and I got the shovel from the one Marine there that was dead, so that worked quite a bit better to get our hole dug. And about the time that we got it deep enough for Bandiera and I to get into, there was a stretcher party that came down over the bank, and we, of course, helped them get down. And when they got through traveling through our area, they had caved in all of our hard work. We didn't have any coverage. And just shortly after the stretcher party went through, we got some mortar shells in, or artillery shells. And, of course, we both dived for the hole. Well, I was a little slower than Bandiera, and I ended up on top of him in this hole, and it wasn't quite deep enough because my buttocks was above ground level. Well, I got these artillery shells, and a piece of shrapnel hit me in the buttocks, and it stung, but it didn't break the skin. It just hit flat, I guess. So after that shelling, we start digging again, and we finally got the hole deep enough for both of us. After we'd gotten in the hole, and of course it had turned dark, and they were sending up star flares that would float down. And as they floated down, they would, of course, oscillate, and the light hit these two Marines, dead Marines, in the hole below us. And the way the flare was going back and forth, it caused shadows on these guys' heads, and it made it look like they were moving. And that was really a scary thing.
Well, the whole thing sounds like a scary thing. And I don't want to lose sight of the fact that you're still a very young man. What were you, 19 years old?
Well, I was at that time, yeah, about 18, 19.
And what was your realistic expectation in facing all of that, even just in 2 days that you've described for us of combat on Iwo Jima? Did you really think you were going to make it out of there alive?
Well, of course, hope springs eternal, and I was certainly hoping so. And after seeing so many casualties, it certainly put some doubt in your mind. Anyway, the following morning, we went into the attack to take this high ground. And, of course, the Japanese were firing down on us from this elevation. And we had to cross this open area. I saw Westberg, who was in our squad. I saw him get hit and his ammo cans fly. And shortly after that, I was just about to dive in a hole, and when I was hit, the bullet, the angle was I was running in, and the angle that the Japanese were shooting at us, the bullet came right down by my head and right down along the inside of my leg, not penetrating, but just grazing me. And then it hit in my next to my heel and then in my ankle, and just went on and into the ground. So it was just one of those what we term $1 million wound. It wasn't serious enough, but it was serious enough that it got me out of combat.
Yeah, it didn't threaten your life necessarily, but it made it so you couldn't fight anymore.
Yeah, and had I been just a few inches to my left, it would have hit me right in the head, but fortunately, it you know, I was in that angle where it didn't hit me directly.
Well, and it sounds like that the angle that they were shooting at you from was pretty much right on top of you, so your head was the biggest target.
Well, I have a big head anyway.
What did that feel like? Were you in pain?
Actually, it felt like I'd been hit with a baseball bat. When I landed in the hole, I landed on top of my left foot, and of course it was all numb, and I was a little leery of looking at it, but I moved it out from under me, and I could see that, you know, it was a grazing wound. So I, of course, all carried a little first aid packet with a compress in there and some sulfur powder, and so I applied that to the wound. The Japanese, he was still firing at me even though I was in that hole. So I realized that this compress that I'd used was white and showed up quite nicely, you know, for a target. So I had a mosquito head net, camouflage mosquito head net, in my pack. So I took that out and wrapped that around the white bandage so that it blended in a lot better. Corman came up and checked me, and he said, well, you've done everything I can do for you. He said, I'll write your tag out and tag you. We have more serious to the wounded up in front, so you'll have to make your way back to an aid station. So I would get up, and I'd run a little bit, and the Jap would fire at me, and I'd throw myself on the ground and roll, and anyway, I finally worked my way back to a point where I was out of the range of the Japanese that was firing at me. And I hobbled as best I could over somebody who was in our squad who had seen me going back, said they never saw anyone run so fast in one leg in their life. Anyway, I got back to the point where there were some walking wounded that were heading to the aid station, and they assisted me in getting down to the aid station where a surgeon or the doctor there checked me out, and I waited there until they called them ducts. They're amphibious vehicles that they had, and so they loaded me on one of those with several other wounded. And I remember one of the corpsmen, he said, "This man that's next to you," he told me, "hold his hand." He had what we term shell shock. He would, least bit of noise, and he would shake. But when you held his hand, it gave him a sense of security, even though he was out of it, so to speak. Anyway, we went out to what had been a troop transport, but they converted it to a hospital ship. So they hauled me up on a crane on the stretcher, and then they took me down into the aid station in there. And as I was lying on the stretcher, I heard someone say, "Hey, Carl," and here it's Westwood, who I'd seen get hit earlier. He was waiting to go in to have the wound cleaned and so forth. And so, anyway, that was quite a coincidence to see him there.
You heard Carl describe how and where he was hit by that Japanese bullet, but if you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can watch a short video in which he points it out for you. When we come back, Carl's road to recovery and what he did once he returned to his unit. Also, what was it like to return to Iwo Jima a half century after he came within inches of losing his life there? Carl Appel of Los Osos, California is our guest today, and we'll be right back after this.